Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Prime Minister Theresa May will officially trigger Article 50 today to begin the process of withdrawal of Britain from the European Union, Brexit. But as the Scottish Parliament votes to hold another independence referendum, is the UK itself on the verge of breaking up? A Chinese father of five was shot dead by police in Paris, sparking street demonstrations and diplomatic protests. As political tensions reach new highs ahead of the presidential election, is this part of a wave of racist violence in France? Iran's President Hassan Rouhani continues his visit to Moscow for a third and final day, signaling increased cooperation between Russia and Iran. But first, we turn to the invoking of Article 50 by British Prime Minister Theresa May. We are joined from London by Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Welcome back, Alexander.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining. The Guardian reported yesterday Nicola Sturgeon has won a key Holyrood vote on her plans for a second independence referendum, triggering accusations from UK ministers that her demands are premature. Sturgeon won by a 10-vote majority after the Scottish Greens backed her proposals to formally request from the UK government the powers to stage a fresh independence vote at around the time Britain leaves the EU in spring 2019. Tell us about the political significance of this move, given everything that's happening in the UK right now.
Yes, the background to this is if we go back to the Brexit referendum in June of last year, England voted decisively for Brexit and Scotland voted decisively against Brexit. The issue of Scottish independence has also been building up steadily over the years, especially since the Scottish Nationalist Party won elections in Scotland in 2005 and formed the government there. So Scotland has been drifting in one direction. England has been drifting in the other direction. The British government, after the Brexit referendum, failed to discuss with the Scottish government the terms upon which Britain will leave the European Union. So the Scots feel that since London is not consulting them, they should go their own way. And now they're going to hold a referendum about whether they should become independent, with the eventual intention of Scotland joining the EU on its own, or at least coming to some kind of arrangement with the EU which will be more favourable to Scotland than the one that Britain looks like it's going to negotiate. So that's the background to all of this. I wonder, I seriously doubt that many people in London expected it in advance, but that is the situation that they now are faced with.
A national referendum was held in Scotland in September 2014. Voters were asked to answer either yes or no to the question, should Scotland be an independent country? 55% of the voters answered no, and 44% answered yes, with a total voter turnout that was high of about 84%. Is that likely to change? I mean, it's a pretty big defeat for the independence referendum. That was 3 years ago.
It was a big defeat, but it was a smaller defeat than I think many people had expected before the referendum was called. And, of course, what has changed and changed dramatically now is Brexit. The fact was that in 2014, no one expected that Britain would be leaving the European Union, which is an institution that many Scots are committed to. Now that Britain is leaving the European Union, that changes the position very radically in Scotland, because whereas before, in 2014, many people in Scotland could look beyond London to Brussels and say, well, however many problems we have with London, we can always go beyond, over London to Brussels. Now that that option will no longer exist, many Scots who voted to remain part of the United Kingdom may feel this time that it is in their interests and Scotland's interest to leave England and to see what arrangements they can make with Brussels directly.
The issue of Scottish independence or Scottish nationalism is not a new issue. I mean, we're talking about a struggle that goes back, you know, 800-900 years, maybe 1,000 years plus. But that's history. I mean, in other words, this history of Scottish nationalism intertangled with struggles between monarchs, struggles between people, struggles between cultures. I mean, it's got a long, long, rich tradition. But what's happening here now is not, is it resurgent Scottish nationalism or is it something, I mean, how would you characterize it?
I think it's a combination of many things. First of all, there is a resurgence of Scottish nationalism. Scottish nationalism began to appear in Britain in the interwar years. That there was the first moves during that time towards shaping a separate identity for Scotland. But it was never an important question until about the 1960s or 70s. Having said this, I think what has radically changed the political situation in Britain is two things. Firstly, a long conservative ascendancy over the United Kingdom, which began with Margaret Thatcher's election victory in 1979. Most Scots are not conservative, and that created a distance between them and London, which had not existed before. And the second is the way in which British conservatism has started increasingly to define itself as a form of English nationalism. And again, I think that has meant that Scots have started to feel themselves more distant from England than they used to be. And of course, that English nationalism has now evolved into anti-Europeanism, which the Scots don't like either. So we have all these various factors starting to come together and creating a division between these two parts of the United Kingdom, which several decades ago had seemed very united together, making the United Kingdom of just a few decades ago very much one country, which it arguably isn't to such extent anymore.
Alexander Mercuris, British Prime Minister Theresa May visited Scotland on Monday in a bid to prevent First Minister Nicola Sturgeon from going ahead with the second referendum on Scottish independence. They held talks for an hour, which were said to be cordial, but Sturgeon said she was, quote, frustrated by a process that appears not to be listening. Can Theresa May, the Prime Minister of the UK, block the referendum from going forward? Will she?
I think legally, constitutionally, she might be able to, and the indications are that she might try. My own personal view is that politically speaking, trying to do that would be disastrous. It would suggest to the Scots that once again London is laying down the law for Scotland, and I think that will actually make more people in Scotland question whether a connection with London is a good idea. I think the correct policy for Theresa May to have followed, and not just recently but over many months, was to consult not just with Scotland but with all the various parts of the United Kingdom very carefully about the Brexit process. That means Northern Ireland, that means Wales, that means the regions of England too. She never did that. Such consultations as there have been entirely within the Conservative Party itself in Westminster. So she failed to do that. And now, by trying at this very late stage to prevent the Scots holding a referendum for independence, which her own actions have to a great extent provoked, I think she's simply adding fuel to the fire.
Alexander Mercuris is our guest. He's the editor-in-chief of the Duran. We're speaking to him from London today. Theresa May, the Prime Minister of the UK, will invoke Article 50, triggering the Brexit, the leaving of the UK from the European Union. The vote took place just over 9 months ago, Alexander, that referendum, that shock shocking like the Trump election was shocking here. What exactly happens today? Will this be the point of no return?
I think it will. There are some people, constitutional lawyers and various people in politics and the media, who are trying to say that invoking Article 50 should not be the end of the process, that there will be a referendum if that referendum, negotiation, if that negotiation doesn't produce a good result, then Britain should look at the whole process again and reverse it. Personally, I don't think that is politically possible. I think that the European states, once they have received the request from Britain to start this process of leaving, which is what invoking Article 50 is all about, I don't think they will want to reverse this process, and I think it will achieve an unstoppable momentum. So I'm afraid that, in fact, we will see Britain leaving the European Union. I don't see any way to stop it.
Theresa May said in January that, quote, no deal for Britain is better than a bad deal for Britain. The UK now has 2 years, starting today, to negotiate an agreement with the EU. But is there a substantial chance that it might not come to a deal with the EU?
I think Theresa May saying that has actually made that possibility much greater, because there will be various people in Europe who will say that if Theresa May is prepared to have no deal at all, why should they ultimately negotiate with her? What is there to negotiate about? Why should they make concessions to somebody who's going to walk away from the table, as Theresa May puts it, if she can't get the deal that she wants? So I think that was a misjudged thing to say. I think that Theresa May is overestimating the strength of the hand that Britain has in these negotiations. And I think a more consensual approach with the Europeans would have worked much better in Britain's interests. I have my own views about Theresa May, which I think are fairly clear by now, which is I think that she doesn't consult widely enough, and I don't think she has thought through her negotiating position carefully.
Alexander, the only other country to ever leave the European Union back when it was the European Economic Community was Greenland. Gus O'Donnell, who is a former British cabinet secretary, said of how long it took Greenland to leave. He said, Greenland has a slightly smaller population than Croydon, a part of London, and it has one issue, and that's fish. So with this one issue, it took them not 2 years, but three. We have multiple issues. The idea that we can do it all in 2 years, I think, is highly unlikely. But if this is the case, won't there be a feeling of deep uncertainty then in British society?
I think there is going to be a profound sense of uncertainty in British society, and I think there already is. I think we've had a long discussion over the last few months about what sort of Brexit Britain will have, and in fact we still don't have any very clear answer. And I don't really see much sign of the British government itself actually forming a very clear view about it. And that's why I come back to this point about Theresa May's comment about walking away even if there is a bad deal. I think that will, as I said, make more people in Europe less willing to negotiate for a deal on what will be an extremely complex and difficult negotiation if the British say, well, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter because we're happy to have no deal at all. So I think that we're looking at a very complicated situation. I don't necessarily see a good outcome to it.
What's the greatest complication? What's the biggest problem or biggest problems, the, you know, one or two that you see?
My own personal view is that by far the biggest problem is about all of these people who have come from the European Union to live and work in Britain, and all of the various British people who are and have established their residence and their businesses all over the European Union. It's very difficult to see how all that can be disentangled quickly within 2 years. It would mean either relocating people away from what have now become their homes and places of business, or it would mean finding some sort of transitional arrangement to deal with them. But if we're talking about no deal, and that's what Theresa May is saying, then of course that may be that there will be no transitional arrangements. So we've got that problem. Then, of course, there's all the various arrangements about the common European, the single European market, the way in which the financial centre, that is the City of London, interconnects with the European economy. There is some people in Britain who, I think, wrongly imagine that the European economy depends on the City of London. I don't think that at all, personally, but that's what some people think. But no real clear idea of how the British financial system is going to be preserved and how it's going to work in relation to a separated European Union into which it has become very tightly integrated indeed. So I would say those are the two biggest and most complicated issues, but the issue of the various populations, that to my mind is the most complicated one of all.
Alexander, we have about 45 seconds. Just, I don't know, maybe this is a ridiculous question, but if there is all of this uncertainty right now as Brexit is triggered today, if the referendum was happening today under the exact circumstances of today, in other words, within the context of this uncertainty, would the outcome of the vote be different today?
My guess is yes. I've seen no polling data which would suggest otherwise. At the moment, if anything, I would say that opinion in England has actually hardened in support of Brexit. That is what the opinion polls I have seen suggest. Whether that will continue to be so in 2 years' time, I am not so sure. In fact, I suspect that by that point, as people see the problems, they might start to become rather more concerned. But at this moment in time, I don't think there's been any change, and I think by 2 years' time, we will be long since past the point of no return.
Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead.
Exactly.
We're talking and have been talking with Alexander Mercuris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Durant. Today is the day in which the triggering of Article 50 begins, the point of no return, the UK about to leave the EU. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Liu Xiaoyu, a Chinese father of five, was killed by police in Paris, sparking street demonstrations and diplomatic protests as political tensions reached new highs ahead of the presidential election. Is this part of a wave of racist violence in France? We are joined from Paris by Louis Georges Tin. He is the president of the Representative Council of Black Organizations of France. Thank you for joining, Louis Georges.
You're welcome.
The BBC reported yesterday that the father of five, the Chinese father of five, 56 years old, was shot dead on Sunday night in Paris's 19th district. Police say he attacked an officer with a sharp object as soon as he came to the door, and the officer was only saved by his bulletproof vest. Another officer then shot him dead. But the family's lawyer says it, quote, totally disputes this account. Tell us more about this case and the demonstrations going on in France.
In fact, there are two different versions. The police said they were under attack because of this man, but the family of the man said he was doing nothing but cooking some fish. And this is why we don't know exactly what's happening. But we know more about the context, and the context in France is about growing racism, and this is the problem.
Indeed. The Chinese community is quite large in France. I believe it's the largest Chinese community in Europe. It constitutes perhaps 2% or so of the population of France of 66 million. But then there are many other people from Africa, from the Middle East. Before we talk about the general issue of racism in France, because, of course, here in the United States, as you know, this is a major problem and has been a major problem, not for decades, but for centuries. But first, let's just talk about what's the Chinese community like in France and how are they reacting?
Well, they are reacting in a very strong way, which is fair and which is it's a good thing. There was a demonstration yesterday. There was also some police brutality after that. Some people were arrested. And now China is asking more explanation to France and asking France to protect people from China. This is the situation now.
After the killing of this Chinese man, 56-year-old father of five in Paris, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying wrote or said that France must guarantee the safety, I'm quoting, guarantee the safety and legal rights and interests of Chinese citizens in France and to treat the reaction of the Chinese people to this incident in a rational way. And she said that China, quote, immediately ordered its embassy in France to activate an emergency response mechanism and make representations with the French side, asking them to get to the bottom of the incident. Let's talk about the diplomatic fallout. Of course, People's Republic of China wants to have good relations with France. It wants to have good relations with all of the EU countries, but it also functions internationally as a guarantor of Chinese people living overseas, away from China. What do you think about the diplomatic fallout here?
It's very strong and legitimate, and it shows a difference with other African countries. Usually, when somebody from Africa has been beaten or killed by the police, you don't see or you don't hear any reaction from Africa. But when somebody from China is killed by the police, China makes a strong reaction, which is great because I think they have the means to gain some respect from France. Most African countries depend from France. They are under pressure. They can't afford to criticize France for its racism. But fortunately, China is in a strong position and has many ways to ask for France some explanation. In fact, most of the time, French people see the Chinese community in a very strange way. For them, they are the good migrants. They are the good ones because you don't hear about them. And according to French people, Chinese people don't have any problem in France. That's not true. They are discriminated against as any other minority. They are shot by the police. And now people tend to realize what's going on. So I think this is a very recent phenomenon. I think it started perhaps 1 or 2 years ago, and the Chinese community is now reacting in a very strong way. They are saying, we are not the good pupils. We have problems because of racism, and we need to react. And this is a new attitude of a Chinese community in France.
You are listening to the voice of Louis Georges Tin. He's the president of the Representative Council of Black Organizations in France. We're talking to Louis Georges in particular about the incident whereby a 56-year-old father of five, a Chinese man, was shot dead by the police when they came to his home. There's different accounts of what happened. The police say that he came with a bladed instrument towards them and that one of the police shot him dead. His family discounts it. They say he was, in fact, cutting and cooking fish at home and that this was an act of murder, just cold-blooded murder. Louis Georges, I want to also ask you about the big picture of what's going on in France with the rising tide of racism and xenophobia directed against people who are not ethnically European or ethnically French in the sense that they or their forefathers and mothers came from France proper. Al Jazeera reported that the current violence, the current demonstrations against the police violence came just after days where several thousand people marched in Paris in a show of anger sparked by the alleged rape in February of a young black man with a police baton and other alleged police abuse. Protesters chanted, "No justice, no peace," and "Police everywhere, justice nowhere," to call for an end to what they say is the use of excessive police force, especially against black and other minority groups. Tell us about the Justice for Theo struggle, because that's the campaign around the young black man who was brutalized by the police in the most vicious way. Talk about that case.
You know, basically, the situation in France is close to the situation in the United States. The main difference is the media. Most of the time in France, when you have police brutality, the media don't speak about the situation. So we tend to say here, we have Ferguson, but without the media. So that's the main difference. Also, the other difference is in the United States, people are being killed by the police with their guns. In France, the police usually don't use their guns. They use their hands. They just strangle you. So you are being killed in a different way, but you die in the same way. So we've had many, many trouble these days. But the poll showed that you've got each month one non-white people being killed by the police or the army. So this is very, very frequent. But most people don't realize. They look at what's going on in the United States. They cry about what's going on in the United States. They say, oh, Mr. Trump is so racist. The United States are so racist. People, black people or non-white people in the United States are so poor, so miserable. And French people take pity on them. But they don't realize the same thing exactly is going on in their own country. And they don't want to know about it. And what is even worse, the socialist government in France, the Labour government, if you like, passed a law that reinforces the right to the police, and the police now has a sort of license to kill. Whenever they kill somebody, they are protected by the law, and they can say that the person was attacking them, even if it's not true. So they've got a sort of license to kill, exactly the same system as the army. So as if we were at war. So when the police says that Chinese person was attacking them, you don't have to know if it is true or not. From a legal point of view, the police has the right to kill the person if they think that it is normal to do so. So we have a terrible law. We've got a racist context. And we know that half of the policemen in France want to vote for Mrs. Le Pen, who is the far-right politician. And this movement is now the first political party in France. So half of the policemen in France are ready to vote for a racist party. And when they go to the streets, this is the sort of conclusions, this is the sort of consequences that you may face. Whatever your color, it's not only black and Arab people, it's also Chinese people, and it is something new, but it's a reality.
Very good. And I hear you. In the United States, where police or security guards kill a person of color, and particularly a black person, every 24 to 28 hours, that's almost every day, the police use the argument, and it's completely upheld in the courts, that they felt threatened. So even if the police shoot somebody in the back when they're running away, all the police actually have to do is say, I felt threatened, and that's defense enough. In other words, as you said, Louis George, here they have a license to kill. They are the judge, the jury, and the executioner. Let's just go back, though. I want to hear more from you about the population makeup, the demographics in France. But tell us a little bit about the Justice for Theo struggle that's sparked so many protests in the recent weeks.
Well, most of the time, when you have police brutality or when people are killed, the police makes its investigation on the police. So you can imagine how transparent this investigation can be. If it is the police that make an inquiry on the police, you won't have any transparent results. So this is why most policemen feel they can do whatever they like. There is no problem.
And what did they do? What actually happened?
Yes, this black guy is called Theo. He was just walking down the streets, and he was arrested by the police for no particular reason. And the situation got worse, and in the end, they put a baton in his ass, and he was violated. This is the word. But, of course, the doctors could prove how hard the brutality was, this anal brutality. But the policeman said it was not voluntary, so he didn't do it on purpose, and it just happened that the baton found itself, found a way to the ass, but it was not a rape.
Yeah, I hear you. So in other words, this man who is bloodied, he's in the hospital, there's no dispute over the fact that this was done to him with a police baton, that it was in fact a form of rape by the police, but the police said it's an accident. We don't know how the police baton ended up where it did, but that, I mean, that's a remarkable sort of, I mean, how else could it possibly have happened? I mean, it's just so ridiculous. So there have been a lot of people out in the streets protesting Louis George. Is it mostly the black community in France that's protesting, or do white people come out and join those protests?
No, the protesters were not only black or Arab people. I think many people in the country, whatever their color, realized that police brutality is something terrible. And especially when this young guy, Theo, was being raped, the police was saying, "You nigger," and other words like this one. But after that, somebody from the police went to the media and said, "Nigger is a sort of, it's an answer, but it's rather acceptable." And another person, a judge, said also in the media that a word like Bamboula is a French insult for Negro, like Negro, if you like. And this judge said these words are quite nice and friendly. So that gives you a perspective about what the police and the justice system in France can be sometimes. So this is why so many people went into the streets. But in the meantime, our Labour government was passing this law, as I said, that reinforces the license to kill for the police. And now we have a country with more and more racism. This is not only about France. This is about Europe. This is perhaps about Western countries nowadays. But it's true that also in France, we have this problem. And we pretend to be the country of human rights while we are the country of people who pretend to defend human rights. That's very, very different. We're not the country of human rights. We're the country of people who speak about human rights.
Louis George, let me ask you, if you're African and your parents are African, they come to France, they come as immigrants, they come as workers, and you are born in France, even though your parents are from an African country, for instance, are you given French citizenship? And then is it a one-tier system?
No, now more and more these previous laws are being repealed. So if you are born in France, you are not necessarily French. You have to wait until 18 years old. Then you have to ask for citizenship and you may be refused. And also, Mrs. Le Pen, I was talking about this far-right movement, her party, which is the first party in France, is claiming for a French national priority. That means they don't want people who are born here to be French anymore. They don't want people who are non-white people, let's be clear. They don't want non-black people, non-white people to have access to housing, access to work. Because if you say French first, of course, or national priority, it means that all the people who were not born French, or let's say all the people who are not white, will not have access to work, to housing. That means she is in favor of compulsory discrimination.
I hear you. So if you're born in France, you only speak French, you've never gone to another country, but if you're not white, if you're black or brown or Chinese, then you are not French. We're going to leave it there. We're out of time. We've been joined from Paris by Louis Georges Tin. He's the president of the Representative Council of Black Organizations of France. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani continues his visit to Russia for a third and final day, signaling increased cooperation between the two countries. We are joined from London by Catherine Shakdam. She is an independent political commentator and author of A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Welcome back, Catherine.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. What's the importance of the talks between Rouhani and Vladimir Putin over the course of 3 days? They began meeting Monday. They'll wrap up today. And although they have met 9 times before, it has never been in this kind of bilateral format.
Well, I think it's important because it's really sealing, you know, this Russian-Iranian cooperation where, I mean, we knew before that there was a great deal of cooperation, especially, you know, against terrorism. But now it's actually translating into, you know, military collaboration and further down the road in a real kind of, you know, coming together of two independent nations at a time where, you know, when the world is not doing great when it comes to, I would say, military engagement and politics, where it's a bit, everything is a bit confused right now, where, you know, the lines have been blurred as to, you know, who's on the right side, who's on the wrong side. And I think that, you know, now you have Iran and Russia clearly making a stand, clearly standing together. And I think it's a good thing because you have the formation of another bloc that is not actually burdened by, you know, imperialism or actually, you know, burdened by war crimes or this kind of, you know, behavior, you know, those patterns that Western capitals have insisted on repeating and following. So, you know, I'm thinking for once now, we have a very clear kind of demarcation where Iran and Russia clearly are, you know, it's more than just friendship. There's an understanding that they need each other to actually bring back sanity to the global conversation. And that actually, countries are now becoming proactive outside the sphere of influence of Washington when it comes to fighting terrorism. And I think it's very interesting because we talked about it before where there's a shift when it comes to, you know, influences and superpowers, what we consider as being superpowers. There's a shift towards Asia and the East now. It has been going on for a while, but it's really kind of coming together and really manifesting. So if people were, you know, in doubt before, I don't think that they are anymore as to the kind of relationship that Russia and Iran have. It's a very close partnership. And it's important because it's not based on, you know, one trying to conquer the other or dictate to the other. It's really about cooperation. And it is something that I think has really driven Russia over the past decade, where it's never been about imposing anything. It's always been about finding common ground and promoting common interests. And I think that's an important dynamic.
Catherine, the two leaders in the two countries, Russia and China, we're talking with Catherine Shakdam, independent political commentator from London, about the meeting taking place in Moscow between Iran, the president of Iran, and Vladimir Putin. The two countries have signed 10 documents of increased economic and political cooperation. There seemed to be some emphasis on energy as well. A joint statement published by the Kremlin said that, quote, special attention had been paid to cooperation in energy, with both sides pledging to continue efforts to stabilize the international market. That's important because, of course, both Russia and Iran are major oil producers, and both of them depend in some, not in some small part, on oil revenues. We know, of course, the volatility in the oil market was such that while prices might have been $110 a barrel like 3 or 4 years ago, they plummeted down to the upper 20s, causing grave economic crisis for countries dependent on energy for their national treasury. Talk about what kind of energy cooperation the two would have. Of course, Russia is not an OPEC a member, but a major oil producer. Go ahead.
You know, for me, what is really interesting is that, again, I'm going back to, you know, the kind of policy that Russia has run for the past decades, where it has really put the emphasis on, you know, cooperation and trying to assert Russia as being a deal maker and trying to position itself not as it's not about imperialism, but trying to force nations to engage economically with Moscow to ensure that, you know, there's good relationship, that diplomacy would run the game rather than, you know, kind of revert back to militarism. And I think this is what you see happen, because a lot of the time you see countries such as Saudi Arabia that have become very belligerent because they have kind of a grand monopoly over the, you know, the world's energy and how, you know, oil is being sold and how is being ferried. I mean, there's a lot of a very kind of insidious, you know, kind of a power play. And I think that Russia is trying to break this. So by engaging Iran, first of all, I think it's kind of politely telling Washington that, you know, sanctions and things like this will not work anymore, that we can't live in a world where countries are just sidelined just because they don't follow the same policies, or they don't agree politically, or even because they choose to have a different system of governance. And so you have, I think it means that politically there's a stand which is being made, and that now we're going towards a new way of doing things, new dynamics, a new, I would say, paradigm, which is good. And on the other hand, Russia is really asserting, and Iran as well, is really asserting some kind of a big comeback on the part of Iran into the world market, and asserting itself again as a superpower. And for Russia to actually assert its position, reinforce them. Because you have to remember that, I mean, I know that a lot of the time Russia has been portrayed in Western media as being, you know, on the verge of bankruptcy. I mean, a whole, you know, different things have been said, and people can't just get over the 1980s. So whenever they think Russia, they think backwards and they think broke and they think whatever. It's not the truth anymore. Reality is Russia is an economic superpower, a political superpower, and a military superpower. And I think that now you're actually seeing the coming together of it. And it's really taking the place of the United States, as it was, let's say, back in the 1970s. And it's very interesting because, again, you see a shift in Asia, where you have countries such as Russia, China, and Iran coming together in terms of energy deals, which means that there will be a break from this kind of codependence on Washington, on Saudi Arabia. So me, I understand it not just as a coming together or rapprochement between those two powers, but more as a break and a willingness to become, to detach yourself from, you know, under the thumb of Saudi Arabia in terms of, you know, this reliance that the world has had on energy coming out of Riyadh or the GCC countries. It's a very interesting power play because it goes beyond just, you know, financial deals or energy deals. It steps into the politics. We need to understand that you can't really, there is no real, you know, line of demarcation in between all those different aspects of, I would say, you know, government. And that, you know, the political will influence the way that deals are being brokered, you know, financial deals, commercial deals, and energy deals in this case. And it's good. Like I said, Iran has a role to play in the Middle East. Russia understands this. And, you know, from the looks of it, President Putin and President Rouhani are on the same page when it comes to the way that they want to move forward together and the way that they want to influence the Middle East, because those deals will definitely, most definitely influence the way that how policies are being shaped in the Middle East. You can't have this kind of two powers coming together and the way that they have operated together in Syria and not understand that it goes just beyond a simple energy deal or even a military agreement, that it's really the formation of a bloc, and that now Washington might be in trouble a little bit, because whenever it's going to come against Iran or Russia, they're going to have to deal with the other as well. And maybe beyond that, more countries in Asia will actually not gang up, but kind of, you know, join that alliance. And try to actually do it differently. We don't have to do it the same way that it has been done, you know, for the past decades. There's other way to explore. Militarism for everything is not just the way to go.
Catherine, an article in Al Monitor reads, Rouhani's trip could reinvigorate the trilateral Iranian-Russian-Turkish axis on Syria and increase its significance, although some high-ranking Turkish officials recently adopted anti-Iranian positions soured Iran-Turkey relations. Ankara's unprecedented and growing rift with some European Union member states has overshadowed the conflict with a more urgent challenge for Turkey than its regional competition with Iran. So you're talking about the bloc, or a potential bloc, or an emerging bloc between Iran and Russia. But in the case of Syria, the bloc was Turkey, Russia, Iran. It wasn't a completely settled bloc. Of course, relations between Turkey and Russia had been very, very bad, and then they have improved. But what do you think about how this is playing out in terms of this meeting in Moscow between Iran and Russia and its impact on the axis Iran, Russia, Turkey, especially in Syria, because there are obviously conflicting agendas there?
Definitely. You know, here's the problem with Turkey. And I think that we need to go back to the nature of this regime. And we can't just dismiss the fact that, you know, President Erdogan is Muslim Brotherhood. And that means that inherently he's going to be more willing to cooperate with the likes of Saudi Arabia or Qatar an Islamist in essence, then actually use reason and be and you know try or choose to be rational about you know the kind of policy that he should be running. The problem that you have with Turkey on paper, reason would dictate that Turkey needs, of course, to befriend Iran and Russia and other powers toward the east, because it makes no sense to have enemies with your direct neighbors. And this is the kind of policy, by the way, that Turkey has followed for more than decades, even centuries, where usually Ankara doesn't choose to make enemies with its direct neighbors. But now since, you know, Erdogan has kind of risen and imposed himself as some kind of a wannabe sultan in a way, then Turkey has actually, I mean, at least the policy that he has run have gone against national interest. So it's very complicated because, like I said, on paper, you would, you know, Turkey has to make friends with Russia and Iran. It makes sense. And it doesn't make sense for Turkey to be even at war with Syria, because it's a ridiculous policy that they're running. They're not going to manage to create safe zone. They're not going to manage to encroach onto Syria's, you know, sovereignty, because, you know, Syria is very much in charge. I mean, it's not, I know that people have said that, oh, President Bashar al-Assad will fall, this will happen. It hasn't happened. The Syrian army is very much in charge. Damascus is very much in charge. And this government is not going anywhere anytime soon, because it's in a state of resistance and it's working. So Ankara would need to wake up right now. Whether it will wake up is another story. But it would, again, I'm going to say that if President Erdogan was actually rational about the future of his country, or even his own future as a statesman and a politician, he would definitely have to reinvent his position towards Iran, especially, and to stop being so sectarian all the time, and to try to stop being so belligerent all the time. Because the way that he's behaving with Germany and other EU states, or the EU in general, and how he has been extremely aggressive in his positions, and even a little bit, I would say, psychotic, is very telling of the nature of his policies and the nature of his regime and what he actually stands for. So you can't look at him and forget that he is Muslim Brotherhood. So if we thought it was a bad idea in Egypt, why is it that it's a good idea in Turkey? You see, there is no, I mean, there's double standards all the time. But at the same time, when you look at him, you need to understand that you see the coming together of you know, Muslim Brotherhood policies. So why are we wondering why it's in a perpetual state of belligerence, and that he's looking to promote, you know, radicalism everywhere, to promote his agenda in the region? This is what they do. This is their default setting by definition. So why be surprised that it's not being rational and that it's dangerous? So Russia tried, Iran tried to extend a friendly hand. He's kind of biting it a little bit. He's not quite sure what to do. So I would say we shall see. But, you know, as far as Erdogan is concerned, I think that the truth is in the pudding, as they say. It's not going to change.
Catherine, we have about 4 minutes left. I want to cover two other topics real quick. An article in the U.S. News and World Report talks about the role of the United States in Iran-Russia relations, saying, quote, "Faced with a Trump administration that appears anxious to drive a wedge between its Iranian and Russian rivals, Russia is more likely to take up the position of mediator it held during tensions between Iran and the West during George W. Bush's presidency, 2000-2008. Do you see that as a distinct possibility? I'm kind of skeptical about that. But that, of course, is the U.S. media. It's the U.S. News and World Report. What's your take? And then I want to ask you one more question in our last 2 minutes.
Well, I don't know if Russia will act as a peace broker. I don't think that Russia wants that because it doesn't need to do that. I think that Iran is quite capable of running its own policies, and I don't think that Iran will take kindly to interferences. I mean, unless it's actually wanted and you know, Tehran actually asked Moscow to intervene. Now, when it comes to Donald Trump and trying to drive a wedge, I think it's a ludicrous policy. It's not going to work. You know, Russia doesn't play games like this. It's not kindergarten politics. I don't think that Mr. Putin, you know, will play the game in that. He doesn't have to. That's the thing. Russia is, you know, has really good relationship with many countries. Why make an enemy out of Iran when Iran is, you know, is very much needed in the region? The same thing goes for, you know, Russian and American relationship. It's a good thing to remain diplomatic and stay in good terms with people, because there's no reason why people have to revert to being violent with each other. So I think it has more to do with Washington changing the way that it behaves towards nations and understand that, you know, it doesn't stand an exceptional power, but it's just a power within other powers, and that it just needs to learn to play nice.
Catherine, let me jump in and ask you in our last 2 minutes about, again, I'm going to go back to the economic dimensions of this trip. Again, Al Monitor reports, quote, "A Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who has final say on all state matters, used his most important speech of the year to criticize President Hassan Rouhani and his administration's economic performance. Khamenei's sharpest remarks are perhaps those delivered in a video message posted March 20th, in which he says, "I am aware of the people's situation. Therefore, I can sense the bitterness of the people, especially the lower classes, from economic problems such as inflation, unemployment, discrimination, equality, and social harms." Ahead of the May election in Iran, is Rouhani trying to boost relations with Russia as an important economic partner? Are there electoral considerations here? Go ahead. We have about 90 seconds.
You have to understand, when it comes to Iran and whatever criticism is coming out of, you know, the leadership, Ayatollah Khamenei, understand that nothing happens in Iran without Ayatollah Khamenei's, I would say so and approval. So there is never a division, or I would say a wedge, in between the presidential office, you know, President Rouhani, and the leadership. They very much work, you know, together, and they agree. So I would say that the former, the leadership, is acting some kind of a vetting agent and is just making sure that policies stay on point. So I think it was more towards the people. The direction was not a criticism. It was more to say that you need to be careful in the way that you do things moving forward, because Iran has stayed in a state of, I would say, you know, resistance against so many plots and ploys to really destroy its system of governance, that it needs to remain vigilant. But this is not to say, you know, that economic empowerment is not welcome in Iran. It's quite the opposite. It's just about the fashion and the way that it's being driven, and, you know, to make sure that the narrative is actually being controlled, and that is not done willy-nilly, that you need to have a structure and you need to do this in stages. So I would say it was just a reinforcement, you know, against those who have actually argued that, you know, President Rouhani is acting against the leadership, that he has his own agenda, which is not the case. It's not true at all. I mean, people make all kinds of stories when it comes to Iran because they don't understand the system. They don't understand that the leadership is the leadership. President Rouhani is really running the political world, but nothing happens, if it's political, diplomatic, economic, social, you name it, without the leadership's approval. And there is no need to have tensions in between the two. They actually don't exist. They have conversations. They have maybe some disagreements. But at the end of the day, they understand, you know, what position they hold, and who's in charge, really, who's leading the show.
OK, we are completely out of time. We've been joined from London by Catherine Chokdam. She is an independent political commentator and author of A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Well, that's all the time we have. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.